So welcome, everyone. This is, I hope everyone's having a good time here at the Conference of World Affairs. Excellent. So you found yourself attending a panel called What You Know Depends on Where You Live, which is a pretty broad title. The description suggests that we're going to be talking about language and cultural traditions and how they affect our understanding and our knowledge base. We've got a handful of really interesting panelists to guide us through that discussion. A couple of housekeeping notes before we start. The first is I was asked to tell you that apparently the party that was scheduled at 4:30 on the Hill has been canceled. I'm sorry. They say because of inclement weather, it seems actually quite pleasant out right now. But
I'll be out there if anyone wants to.
Yeah, there you go. I am merely the messenger. So we'll start with that. Thing two is, so I have my iPad up. I'm not doing email. I have the moderator. There's a moderator app for the conference. You guys may have seen this in some of the other sessions. Not all of them are using it. But if you have the CWA app downloaded, you can at any time send in a question, and it'll pop up here, and I'll get to see it. And so what I would prefer to do would be to have you all do that rather than kind of wait to the end and have people do kind of a separate Q&A thing, and that way I can kind of just work the questions that you all have in. If anyone is having trouble with that, if you can find someone who looks official to help you out, and if you're really having trouble and you have an urgent question, just raise your hand. Despite the fact that we're up on stage, we'll be pretty casual about this. So let's jump in. So I'm going to introduce the panelists just so we can get going on the actual questions. And I guess first I should say my name is Seth Levine. I live in Boulder, Colorado. I'm a founder and a partner in a venture capital firm called Foundry Group. We invest in technology businesses really around the country. And I'm also very involved in sort of entrepreneurship on a global basis. I advise a bunch of funds in Africa and the Middle East and some other places. So I really work with entrepreneurs kind of all around the world. To my left is Carolina Behe. She's the Indigenous Knowledge Science Advisor for the Inuit Circumpolar Council, the ICC, in Alaska. Her work within the council ranges from topics within food security and climatic variability to management and policy. She also serves as the ICC head of delegation of the delegation working on the conservation of the Arctic flora and fauna under the Arctic Council. Welcome. To her left is Christopher Horsthief. He's a research professor and consultant focusing on group dynamics of collectively traumatized communities. I'll ask you a little bit more about that later. One of his key beliefs is that indigenous language and culture are inextricably linked. And we'll definitely be talking about that. Next is Mark Thomas. Mark is a professor of neuroscience and scientific director of the medical discovery team on addiction at the University of Minnesota. I always want to say the U. At the University of Minnesota. And then finally is Po Chi Wu. Po is a self-described innovation provocateur. We'll ask about that too. Who teaches entrepreneurship at the School of Business and Management at the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. He's also an author. And he's spent his time both in Silicon Valley and in Asia. We'll be talking about that as well. So let's jump in. So, Christopher, you have an interesting name, and since we're talking about language and the relationship between language and community, language itself, why don't we start there? Wasn't planning on that, but you you told me you had an interesting story. So I'd be curious to hear the background and history on that.
Sure, so I do have a bit of a background in linguistics, and so the idea of the Sapir-Whorfian hypothesis, that your language somehow determines your culture or your view or the way that you think, it's an area that I've thought quite a bit about, so it's a nice introduction. My community is the Kronacha speech community, which is kind of at the confluence of BC, Alberta, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. So getting anything done in our community is really difficult. Two countries, two provinces, three states, a number of churches and federal programs that have been designed to take care of us. And essentially that meant physically beating the language and the culture out of our community. There was a priest named Father Kokola who at one point came into our community summoned all the families forward and had a list of names from the Bible and all of that oral tradition, all of that history, all of those stories that told us who we were and what our place in the world was, all went away. Our last names became Pierre, Sam, Luke, Matthew, Louis, all these kinds of things that didn't really describe us. So about 20 years ago, I had the idea, I'm not a Sam. I don't even really know what that is. It's completely foreign to me. I want to go back to a traditional name. And so I started working with our elders, and I went and sat down with one of them, and one of my uncles said, I'm going to tell you a story, but I'm going to give you your name, but I'm going to do it in a traditional way. It's not just an arbitrary thing. There's a story that goes with this. So he told me about one of my relatives whose name was White Cloud, and he said he was a very well-known horse thief. And Gyakashakhtsen is how you pronounce it. And he said, you probably don't want to write that, so you should go by horse thief. And the thing that was important about White Cloud is he was our most accomplished horse thief. The units of analysis in our economies used to be horses. Travel, work, all of that. They're very important to us. And if you could go to another tribe and take a horse without getting killed or killing someone, that was a really big deal. It was a very honorable thing. Later, I served in the military, and at Fort Knox, when they'd run the Kentucky Derby, there was a lot of jokes about I wouldn't be allowed to leave post during that time. But White Cloud was such a good horse thief and so accomplished that when they finally caught and killed him in southern Alberta, they outlined his body in stone. And it was a way for that other community to say, yeah, this person was really good at what they did. And now, interestingly, it's an archaeological site in the province of Alberta. So when my uncle gave me that name, he said, this is really important. This is a part of who you are. You're going to travel all over. You're going to go and meet people. You're going to debate with them. You're going to argue. And this is a way, you know, the new unit of analysis for your economy and your job and being a professor and those kinds of things is being able to go and interact with people. So he told me to use that name and be really proud of it and use it as a bit of armor when I go out and interact with the world.
I just wanted to jump in because when I first met Christopher a couple minutes ago, I asked him if when he was young, he was tempted to change his name. So he explained this whole story had been changed and he changed it back. And my part of the story is I'm a first generation immigrant from China, actually from Hong Kong. And when I was growing up in Eastern Canada, I was embarrassed to be, well, I didn't know what it meant to be Chinese or Asian. And of course, I was made fun of, like all kids, you know, with something different. And I was probably like one of very few, very small number of Asians in the school. I'm talking about primary school and so on. And I looked for years, I looked for a Western name. I tried all kinds of things. I was interested in Greek mythology and these names and those names and French names because I love the French language. I couldn't find anything. And eventually, when I got to university, I decided that I would be much more comfortable with my Chinese name.
That's great. It really talks to the power of language and obviously, in these cases, power of names. So let me frame this next question just for a moment, and Caroline, I'm going to throw it over to you. So I recently read a book. It actually was by a CU professor. It's called The Knowledge Illusion. And the context of the book was essentially that we think we know a lot of things, but the reality is we actually know very little about most of the things that we think we know about. And that essentially communities are the storage systems for knowledge, right? As a community, we know a lot of things about a lot of things, and we rely on other people's knowledge to inform our own knowledge, right? We might think we know how a zipper works, but it turns out when you actually ask people to describe how a zipper works, to pick a sort of silly example, but one from the book, most people actually don't really know how a zipper works. But you don't have to know how a zipper works because other people, not many, but other people do, and those are the people that make zippers, so we all have zippers, which is great. But it was an interesting context about this sort of community as a storage mechanism for knowledge. So I wanted to ask for you, and maybe Poe also, you could jump in on this, to just comment on, sure, everyone can, to comment on this concept of what is the meaning of knowledge? What does it mean to know something? And particularly when you're working in specific communities, how do you think about the community's collective understanding as opposed to an individual's understanding?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Well, I think first this question makes me think about the, you know, at the Inuit Circumpolar Council, we work across these different scales, and so it makes me think about how we have to address that question you just asked differently across those scales. So I think the first thing that I thought of when you were talking about it is that our communities have indigenous knowledge. So, you know, the Inuit are in Chukotka, Alaska, Canada, and Greenland. And there's many different dialects of the language. There's many different communities. There's differences between the communities, but they all share a commonality within their indigenous knowledge. And some of that commonality is that it actually has its own methodologies and evaluation and validation processes. And so it's unique from other communities because it's their processes that they use to make decisions. But the other part of it, too, in trying to explain that at some of these international tables seems to be pretty important in order to validate that indigenous knowledge or to help express that indigenous knowledge is equitable to science and needed to be included at equitable tables to address the challenges that we're facing. But then the other part of it is that this knowledge does belong to the community or to the peoples, and that it's more than one people's. And the way that we address that is by giving the community decides. Because again, you know, just in Alaska, there's 97 different tribal councils that are Inuit. There's four different dialects among those 97 different tribal councils. They're within 81 villages. And not everybody has had the same experiences. And so they all have different ways of how they want to deal with their information and how they would like that shared. And so our job is to make sure that's happening. So at a community level, that could mean that the tribal council is deciding what information is shared. It could be that the elders council is deciding what information is going to be shared. A lot of the information we share is internally as indigenous people sharing the information together. So we don't have this kind of outside kind of rules, but there are guidelines about who gets to talk about something, right? There's some things that are shared from a whaling captain that only the whaling captain should be sharing because they're the only ones that have that knowledge to give context to what they intend to be saying. So I think the big part is really always taking direction from the community on how that is portrayed and making sure that they have ownership of what their information is and how to share it. So when we do go to these international tables and saying we really need there to be equitable room for indigenous knowledge here, we also have to then come back and have discussions about how do we want that to look, because it doesn't mean that we always want to share all of the indigenous knowledge. And the last part I would just say about that is I didn't grow up with my mom saying, let me share some indigenous knowledge with you. So it's really kind of making these compromises of it. And even language has to do with that because we're always trying to explain things in English. And so really having to think about what compromises do you want to make sure that your voice is at the table, and what do you want to make sure there is not a compromise involved to ensure that the power is with the people and that they're maintaining ownership of their knowledge.
It brings up a really, like, an interesting point, right? Because a lot of people speak different languages, right? And sometimes things aren't translatable, right? My grandfather's native language was Yiddish. So we spoke some Yiddish growing up. And there were some words I was trying to explain to my kids, and I was like, it's like a feeling that, you know, you just can't describe it. And imagine sort of transferring that knowledge without the context of the same language becomes even more challenging. Po, before I jump to another question, did you want to take a shot?
Yeah, I have a couple of comments on that. So, first of all, as I mentioned to you earlier, the Chinese language is fundamentally different because it is not alphabet-based. It's pictographic. And, of course, it's even more ancient than many of the written languages, the Western written languages. But because it's pictographic, it draws on different parts of the brain. And you may have some comment on that. There have been people who've actually studied this. And it's really quite fascinating. So, again, certain kinds of things are more easily expressed in one language or another. So, for example, abstract concepts, such as venture capital, can be very concise about that.
I don't even know what it means.
In English, you at least attempt a concise definition. In Chinese, the Chinese language is enormously rich, 80,000 characters plus. There are very few ways to describe abstract concepts, because it is a rich descriptive language that's more based on practical things. So right away you can see that the different way that we perceive the world is very much affected by language, and we can only think in a language. So native English speakers think in English. I don't know about Native American language, but I can tell you when I think in French or I think in Chinese, my logic is actually different. Now, I wanted to start off with a general comment about knowledge, because you asked about that. And this is a serious problem, because actually, you know, we're all looking at these chairs here, some sort of a burgundy color, and actually each one of us is seeing a slightly different color. But we can all sort of agree it's this kind of burgundy color. So we have filters. And my point is, we have a lot of cognitive filters, and that's where we get caught. The assumptions and other filters that we are conscious of, and many that we're not conscious of. And this distorts what is truly reality. If you could define true reality as something that is unfiltered. Now, specifically to address the idea of some kind of communal knowledge, and I'll make this relatively quick, I was thinking of two different things. One is sort of the implicit knowledge, this cultural knowledge, cultural heritage side, which is very, very important. But then there are also explicit kinds of communal knowledge, such as in the practice of medicine, healing. So North American Indians, East Indians, the Chinese, we have something called traditional Chinese medicine. And these are stores of vast knowledge and wisdom that have been accumulated over thousands of years and untested in a so-called scientific way. So they're messy, you know, to use sort of database language. They're very chaotic, they're messy, they're hard to classify, but it doesn't mean that we can ignore them. We really should. There should be more study and analysis and some more scientific testing to really validate how do we translate, basically, what is wisdom in a more ancient tribal context, and what do we can we believe in our current context.
Now, that's a perfect setup, because I want to ask you, Mark, a question about knowledge.
Can I just this is fascinating conversation to me. I have spent most of my adult life in a university, and so I've been always like sequestered away from real life in this university environment. So I was just at a panel on artificial intelligence, and one of the panelists was talking about how if you really want to learn something and you talk to kids who are trying to learn something, they go to YouTube and they watch, you know, hours and hours of videos, and this is a way that, you know, perhaps a wave of the future in the way people learn. And it got me thinking, you know, I mean, universities really do have a place, and so, I think universities can be better places for the storage and distribution of knowledge, and the more inclusive they are in including different kinds of knowledge that come from other cultural traditions, because let's be honest, most of it is not including these other cultural traditions. But I think, I mean, this is an amazing event that we're in the middle of right now, and this is happening at a university. I mean, where else would this happen today? I mean, I'm not sure that it does happen other places. And so we need to, rather than thinking about what we do instead of using universities as a place for knowledge dissemination, we need to think about how to strengthen them and make them even better at what they do.
So let's build on that actually for a second, because this is a nice lead into what I wanted to ask you about, because then I want to tie that back to some of the other things that Carolina and Christopher have been talking about. So let's talk about, I mean, you're a research scientist, and let's talk about sort of what knowledge means in the context of the academy, if you will, at sort of accepted science. And just, I want to set the table for what constitutes things we quote-unquote know, and then use that to talk about the bridge between scientific, what we consider to be scientific knowledge, and what we might consider to be, I guess we would call, in the context of this discussion, indigenous knowledge, but other types of knowledge that are just as valid. But let's start with what constitutes scientific knowledge, and how do you know something in your work?
So I don't consider myself much of a philosopher, I have to be honest. So I'm just going to break that question down into some sort of concrete terms that I think about on a daily basis. So, you know, I'm a laboratory scientist, and so we do a lot of experiments on rats and mice with the ultimate goal of learning how addictive drugs affect the brain in ways that we can try to use that information to learn about people and how their brains change with traumatic experiences or exposure to addictive drugs. And so, you know, for a long time in doing this kind of work, which I find fascinating just in its own right, you can spend your whole life digging in deeper and deeper to smaller and smaller problems and be quite successful doing that in an academic setting. And as I was doing this and, you know, having a decent amount of success at it in terms of the academic world, I started to think more deeply about, you know, what it is we were learning and the knowledge that we were creating and disseminating to other scientists, and just what the meaning of that might be in terms of the larger questions. And so just in the past 5 to 10 years, gotten much more interested in how do we take that, those little tiny bits of knowledge, and actually do something with them that could benefit people. And I don't want to congratulate myself too much. I just think there aren't that many people who are trying to do that, in that it's kind of a risky thing. It's much easier to succeed in that smaller, more defined efforts of learning the bits and pieces with your experiments, that to take that knowledge and sort of try to bring it out into the world. Does that kind of get to where you
were?
Well,
we'll keep unpacking it a little bit. Because I think where I'm going to head now is, and let me start, Carolina, with you, because I know you do a lot of work trying to bridge, in some respects, indigenous knowledge and what we consider to be scientific knowledge. Talk a little bit about how you do that and the value that indigenous knowledge can bring to sort of our broader understanding of a problem, right? For people that have lived and worked and been one with the land for ages and ages, not people that have come up to study it for...
Okay, that's good. That's a good ending for it. Thank you. Well, I think we started by first recognizing that our leaders have been trying to say the same thing for over 50 years. And I'm talking specifically within the work that the Inuit Circumpolar Council does, this international work. And this international work came because Inuit had this foresight that they needed to come together to address common concerns with a common voice. One of those common concerns is safeguarding the Arctic, its food security, it's safeguarding people's ways of life, it's safeguarding Indigenous people's ways of life. So when we're talking about this knowledge, we're being very specific that it's Indigenous people's knowledge that we're talking about. And what we saw was that even 50 years ago, our leaders were trying to explain what Indigenous knowledge was, and using the same words. That I was looking at reports that were using the exact same words, and we have to start to wonder, like, why can they not hear what we're saying? And so in talking to some elders, we realized we have to start to try to explain some of these concepts. And so we even have a definition that's used in some of these forums, where we're very specific that we're talking about a systematic way of thinking. We're talking about something that includes biological, physical, spiritual, cultural pieces, something that's passed from generation to generation, something that is alive today. It's not in the past. It's built upon every single day by all of us. And again, it belongs to Indigenous peoples because it's rooted in our cosmologies. It's rooted in the way that we're taught to see the world, the way we're taught to be within the world. And a key part of that is that we're part of the ecosystem. And so this is a big part of what we need to do when we're educating scientists and when we're bringing scientists and Indigenous knowledge holders together, is to explain what a holistic view is. That a holistic view comes with a hierarchy. It means that humans are part of the ecosystem, that there is a reciprocal relationship, and that things are focused on relationship. You know, we're focused on the relationship between the sea ice and the walrus, between the current and the sea ice, between the temperature and the sea ice, between the salinity or the salt and the sea ice, between the stomach contents of the walrus and the sea ice, but also between that young boy that keeps being taken out every single year to learn his relationship with the walrus. And then when he gets his first catch and brings it to an elder and becomes a provider as opposed to being provided for, and he is rooted in his cultural identity. This is our cosmology. This is you're rooted in your relationship with your environment. This is what it means to have a holistic view. It's what it means when we say you can't separate the health of the animals from the health of the people or the health of the sky or the health of the land. It's all interconnected to each other. So when we're at these meetings, the very first thing we have to do is explain what trust and respect is. because we're all having conversations in different ways and communicating with each other in different ways. And sometimes when we bring Indigenous knowledge holders to the tables, sometimes people can be very dismissive because you might hear someone say something that is different from the way you think and you have a knee-jerk reaction. So if I say to somebody that animals give themselves to us, they choose to give themselves to us, a scientific colleague may find that very annoying because they don't believe that the animal can think. But it's not for them to decide that. It's for them to trust and respect that that's the Indigenous knowledge holder's perspective. And so we really have to focus on that equity. And so when we're having those discussions, it really comes down to trying to educate how to have a respectful communication with each other. But then the other part is these large-scale systems and trying to explain that if you want to be looking at ecosystem approaches, you want to be looking at adaptive solutions, you have to start understanding what Indigenous knowledge is saying to you about relationships and focusing on those relationships instead of these siloed individual pieces. Thank you.
I want to pull on a thread there, actually, that I think is really interesting. Christopher, this is for you. Because, Carolina, something you said made me think about the relationship between language and understanding or language and culture, right, which can both be a barrier in the example you just described, and in some cases can be a facilitator, can bring people together. In the bio, Christopher, that I read for you, it talked about your belief in the linkage between language and culture. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that, because I think it's a nice segue from that answer.
So one of the very first meetings that I got to facilitate in my community when I moved home was I got all of the elders from the Canada and the United States communities, and we sat in a little log cabin. And I was supposed to ask them if they would take a meeting with the biologist that was going to be naming a particular species of fish. And the old ladies immediately were like, "Why? Latin is dead. Your taxonomy doesn't work. Our language isn't dead yet. We have families of animals, and each of those families, the name for them tells you about them. That's katsuptak. Those are the hooves. Those are the ungulates. They have hooves. That's what, in our language, that's what it means. Kiyachu. Those are the animals that split the water. Those are the fish. They split the water. They're the only ones that split the water like that. Bakhu. Those are the animals that live on, those are the waterfowl. They live on the water. And then they would break each family down and talk about how the name of each one of those animals actually says something in our language. And then they would talk about the reason we call our canoe the sturgeon-nosed canoe is because the hull mimics the shape of a sturgeon. Because of the vegetation in the water, that sturgeon is very effective and very efficient, and we wanted to build our world to look like that. That's why we call them sturgeon-nosed canoes. And they started to go through this process of naming all of these ideas. And they got to the point where they said, every researcher that comes in does their study, and at the end they give us a three-ring binder, and they get their PhD or they get their thesis, and they take our information, they use it for what they're doing, they encode it in another language, and then force it back on us. That's exactly what Linda Tawahi-Smith says is colonization. And they said, we want to develop positioning materials so that we can have posters that present our language, our species, our place names, just as valid as anyone else's. We want to start seeing ourselves as being as valid. Most recently, we got a really nice federal grant from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research to research the topic of what is health. And we changed the format of doing it. We told the researchers, before you get here, you need to have a long conversation with us that we call reciprocal calibration. There's things that you want to know, but you can't just show up here and ask them, because by the time you get to our community, if you've decided your epistemological framework and your research methodology and you have your specific research questions, your research does not benefit us at all. So talk to us. We'll refine some things. We'll come up with research questions that mean something to both community. Now there's something that we want to do. Now we want to know this just like you do, but we're not going to translate it all into English, put it into a framework that you like, name it in Latin, put it in this other database, send it to the... You can do all of that with it, but we have to find a way for it to make sense in this part of the world, because this little part of the world described by our language is distinct. Like every other speech community, there are things about our language that describe our place names, our people, where we came from, that are very different from any other language that travels easily, like English or Swahili or another language that's easy to kind of pick up and control people with. It takes a long time to learn, but they have remained in the same area for millennia, and they've become increasingly specific over time. And you only get access to that information when you work with us and have a relationship, and we get to kind of do this reciprocal calibration. As long as our values are in that discussion, we're happy to be a part of it with you. Just don't tell us that it's only going to be from your perspective. That's not useful to us, and we won't work with you anymore. And in Canada, you don't get federal funding anymore unless you have an agreement with the local Indigenous First Nations people. We actually have a say now. You don't get your grant money until you have an agreement with us, because you're impacting us.
You want to jump in on that?
Yeah, just a quick, short validation. I mean, the same thing happens with Chinese. The Chinese language, again, very descriptive. So they have names for everything, right? It's not like when the Westerners came along, there was, you know, whole new species that were totally unnamed. And you didn't make it so explicit, but it is, of course, language is a tool of politics and of conflict. And, you know, this is a topic for another session, but it's really very important to think about. You use the term colonization. It is, unfortunately. When you bring your language from one country and you impose it on another, or even you know, a group of people, not necessarily a country, or defined as a country, you really do have to have a better mutual understanding, a mutual empathy, respect. This, you said that very clearly. It's a respect for values, and it must be reciprocal.
We're, you know, we're sitting here in Colorado, and it strikes me listening to this that you know, we have many tall mountains, and they tend to be named after the white guy that showed up in the 1800s and is like, no one's been up here before, I shall name, you know, the Ellingwood Peak. And of course, that's not true, and I think that sometimes Western culture has the, not sometimes, often Western culture has the effect of believing that they were the first when they were the, you know, 51st, and not necessarily paying tribute to cultural heritage. I want to pick up on something that Christopher talked about. Mark, put you a little bit on the spot. You're a research scientist, right? And part of what Christopher was talking about is being collaborative in terms of deciding on the types of things that you want to do research on. And I know you do a lot of research on addiction, pain medications, opiates, things like that. In what ways do you get sort of feedback from the community, meaning the population that is struggling with addiction versus the community that is the researchers that want to study the people that have addiction, to decide what your next experiment might be? How do you think about that in a collaborative sense?
I have to be honest, not much until recently. I mean, because my research and a lot of other people who do what I do, I mean, I've been focused on the laboratory research part of it, which is working on rats and mice in the lab, and so their perspective isn't often considered. But you know, in terms of broadening it out, because that's where we're getting to. We're starting to think about, okay, now how do these things that we're learning, these kind of, you know, reductive pieces of information from the lab, how do we actually put them into a context that would be useful to people? And so starting now, you know, perhaps decades too late, but, you know, starting to think about, okay, now what is it, and this has been a big effort of ours in the past couple of years, what is it that we could provide that would actually be useful to people? So going out and talking to, I mean, it sounds so obvious, right? It's ridiculous, but I mean, this is, you know, like going out and talking to the people and communities who are struggling with substance use disorders. You know, if there was a magic bullet of some kind that we could develop, and we don't often think of it that way, but, you know, what would it be? What would be truly useful to you? And so it's we've really just begun to think of it in that way. And actually, you know, being part of the panel.
Teleporter would be super useful.
Yeah, but being part of the panel and hearing what the fellow speakers have to say, I mean, it's really thought-provoking, I must say.
Well, this is a question that's just popped up on my screen, which is the question around globalization. Is it a good thing or is it a bad thing? Or I guess I should say, in what ways is it a good thing and in what ways is it a bad thing? We'll call this a jump ball so anyone can jump in on it.
For us, the biggest thing that we've done is no culture is static, right? Once you stop evolving, you become less relevant and your problem-solving tools are not used and you die, your community goes away. We have just had to go through the process where our collective boundaries have been violated. They're still very permeable, and we just tell people, first off, there are some really great tools out there that we might not understand. As long as those new tools don't disrespect those older philosophical centers where we make meaning, where we make sense of the world, our language, our spirituality, our genealogy, those long roots, then use those new tools so that we can have a more informed role in healthcare, in health research, in politics, in legal studies, all over the place. I'm a research scientist too, and there's not many from my community, and I get to go and do things like this, and it's because math, calculus, statistics, social network, analytics, all of those algorithms were tools that didn't conflict with the way that I pray, the way that I raise my daughter, the way that I relate to my community. I was able to protect those very old important things while becoming very proficient in some of these new tools. So as far as globalization, just make sure you're protecting those really... It'd be like if I came to your house and said, I want to come have dinner with you, but instead of saying grace, I want you to use a different Bible. Right? You wouldn't go, it would be weird. You make everybody feel really weird. Well, we had that happen for a long time. So we just stopped being able to differentiate between new tools as something that would help us and new tools as these, you know, old tools of dispossession. So once we started to differentiate, here's a new thing that will help that doesn't really impact these older things, then it's something that could be really helpful for us.
I'd like to describe globalization as a form of innovation, right? Because that's literally what it is. And think about how innovation happens. In this case, as with many new technologies, it's sort of inevitable, right? If we don't have globalization, what do? We close borders. We think we're going to be totally self-sufficient. And the way the world economies have been so interlinked over the last X number of decades will never go back. And in fact, evolution is kind of like that. Evolution, right, is going only one direction. There's a physical law for that called entropy. But more importantly, the course of change of innovation, and particularly in globalization, the first step is physical, right? Physical things change. I can move from one place to another. I can change street names, right? Everything's in English or whatever. That's relatively easy and straightforward. Whether it's effective or not is not the point. The next level is you start to think about, okay, how do we change how we interact, such as business models, right? Business models in the U.S. don't work in China and vice versa. And that's because there's a great deal more that needs to be considered when you think about what does it actually mean to be more of a global citizen, as it were. And then the third stage is actually mindset, right? You have to kind of go through the physical first and then some embodiments, because those are familiar, right? The problem of moving from something that you know to something you don't know is a lot of steps in between. And of course, you don't know what they are, but we always start with the changes that we are familiar with because that's within our comfort zone. It's only when we get to the borders of our comfort zone, which are all about fear, and fear because of miscommunication and other things, that we can actually have a breakthrough, literally, in terms of becoming more mutually respectful, of beginning to understand another person's values. Because initially you always start with imposing your values, because that's your assumption. Your assumption, without knowing, is, oh, other people must think the same way I do. And that is the fatal flaw.
Carolina, let's jump on that. A lot of your work involves trying to bring together your local community, indigenous communities, to work on very specific problems around climate change and other very important issues. How do you bring those two sides together? How have you been successful in getting people who are coming in from elsewhere to study or try to have impact? How do you get them to understand the indigenous view of what's actually happening? And what are some examples of maybe where you've been successful in changing that thinking? Someone came in with maybe a framework, and you were able, and you disagreed with it, and you were able to get them to understand whatever was going on in a different fashion.
Okay, thank you. Well, I think there's a lot of different tools and a lot of different steps that we have to take. In some ways, and Christopher even mentioned, the community can decide what questions need to be asked. Right? And my friends tell me all the time in communities that a scientist will come in and they have this question and they waste all this money to find this answer that they already knew. And they could have just sat with them and figured out a question that advanced that a bit more. But these kinds of things really come down to ethics and equity. And so we really see that we have to work on that quite a bit. And sometimes that has to deal with working with individual people, and sometimes it has to do with trying to change policy to actually support a different way of thinking. And that has to do with creating ethical guidelines for research, but it also has to do with the way that decisions are being made. And in recognizing that there's a huge amount of power dynamics and a huge amount of other value systems that have been imposed on Inuit for a very long time, across all four countries, right? And those value systems are still being imposed through the decisions that are made. And so a lot of it, again, has to do with education. There's so much interest in the Arctic, from tourists, researchers, to industry, to governments. Everybody wants to have a say of what's happening in the Arctic. And they're all bringing their value systems with how they think that should be set. And these international forums we're working on, they kind of wanted to say, well, if they do use information to make the decision, because they don't always use information to make the decision, it's usually coming from Western science. And they only want it to come from that Western science. So providing them tools of what it means to actually involve Indigenous knowledge holders. And this really means correcting their thinking, because they oftentimes grew up thinking, oh, I really appreciate Indigenous peoples. Please come here. We really want you to come here and work with us. But as long as you talk and think the way we do. And so we have to explain that to them of what that means, and that it's something else. We have to explain that it's not for them to interpret Indigenous knowledge. The Indigenous knowledge holders will tell them what it means. And then still, again, with that policy part, you have to just keep on changing. So under the Obama administration, we were able to make a small step of within this one area that these Indigenous knowledge holders would specifically advise on decisions being made. And then another administration comes in and they change it. And they say, no, we don't need you to tell us what to do. And then in some of the other countries, that happens all the time. Happens all the time in Russia. We don't need you to tell us what to do. And so really actually making space. And so some of the successes that we've had in changing the way people think have been through the projects that we do. So if we have this food security project, helping people understand that food security is not just about nutrients or calories, helping them understand that culture is part of that, helping people understand that they need to focus on relationships between biodiversity and the physical world in order to see what's happening, that they have to understand that culture is part of that. That's been very successful for us to use those kinds of projects that communicate directly from the Indigenous knowledge holders, what the elders are telling us to communicate with them, and then to help them try to incorporate some of the concepts from Indigenous knowledge on the work they're doing. But I have to really go back to it's really important that we understand that there's a systemic issue of lack of equity here. And so all of these pieces we can work on, but if we don't work on that part, then it just keeps falling down.
So this actually is a great, I wanted to ask you about something about that word equity. So we often talk about, and this is, I'll start with you, Carolina, but I think others will have some thoughts on this. I mean, we often talk about equality, right, by which we mean sort of it's the same, right, these two things are equal, as opposed to equity, in which case we're really talking about is it fair? And the distinction, I think, is really important. I think I saw this in something maybe you had written, which is what made me think about it. But I'd love to dig into that just a little bit. Like, there's a difference between equality and equity, and that difference is really important. Mm-hmm. But we often use those words almost interchangeably.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're very specific to use the term equity because they're very different. People often think, oh, you have five scientists and five Indigenous knowledge holders, it's equal. It's far from having equity. It doesn't matter if you're sitting at the table if you're not actually given a voice, if you're not actually heard. It also is a big problem that you're always asked to be at somebody else's table. They're not coming to your table. They're not having the conversation or the discussion in the way that you would have it, or just building. It doesn't even have to be the way Inuit would have the discussion. You could build a way together that works well for both scientists and Indigenous knowledge holders. But it means changing those systems, the way that we're doing things. So, for example, when you come to the table, the information that you come to the table with are coming from different places. You have to make room for them to be coming from different places.
Christopher, is it important for people who are coming in to do research in your community to have a baseline knowledge of not just the community, but the language of the community? Is that, will they sort of, would, I mean, is that even possible? But is that something that, that is a step in the right direction, or is that not necessary?
Yeah, unfortunately, our language is really different from English and really hard to learn. But I can tell you that the last couple of really great federal research projects we got were named in the language. And now when we present them at research conferences, people do get to hear our language. With respect to this idea of equality and equity, our community has been investing in our social and our cultural capital since the beginning of time, but nobody really cares. This idea that you're always going to someone else's community. Everything in BC happens in Vancouver and Victoria, and we're the other end of the province. And so we'll tell people, you want to know how to change? Get some travel budgets and come to our community. And they would say, well, we have enough money to bring one of you over here. And I was like, it doesn't work like that. You bring your team here at least a few times, have some community dinners, meet people, and have this group conversation. That way our social capitals are equitable. We're exchanging things efficiently between both parties, because if we're constantly putting one person from our research team on a plane and flying over and eating terrible food in a terrible hotel somewhere, not getting a good night's sleep, being cranky at your meetings and then flying back, that's just not helpful. It's always awesome though when people come to the community and they learn how to introduce themselves in the language. I'm always like, yeah.
It's got to be. Poe, you've lived and worked in Eastern cultures and Western cultures. And I'm curious if you have some observations about some of the differences. You've described a couple of them, right? The Chinese language not being very factual and not necessarily abstract. Are there other things that you've noticed being kind of having a foot in both of those worlds?
There are so many. But I wanted to follow up a little bit on this equality and equity conversation. I think this is truly very important, because when we think two things are equal, that is from my perception. I say, oh, you're equal to another female here in the room because you're female. Mm-hmm. And in a way, that's truly reductionist. That's whatever, you know, image, set of characteristics that I said you are. So, oh, okay, you two are Native American. But that's not a correct either. So the equity has to have a respect from your side. It's not from my side. Right? So it's the perception. This is a very, very important and very interesting problem, because, of course, China went through this with Western cultures as well, right? The infamous Taiping Rebellion, the whole thing, right? The Chinese version of the Boston Tea Party off the coast of China ruined China. And by the way, it was all thanks to heroin, right? It was all because the Brits wanted to continue selling heroin. That's another long political story. But it is about the imposition of values. And this is so, so, so important. And unfortunately, with language, you're limited. You know, our language, our ability to communicate and exchange how we feel about values and how we think about values is limited by language. And this is, you know, really, I think, a very fundamental concept I really like our audience to be more cognizant of. So, you know, one other thing about the Chinese language, which I mentioned to you, and I've mentioned this in a couple of other sessions, there's a wonderful book called The Geography of Thought. It's written by an academic professor at Yale University, and he studied in particular the difference between the Chinese language and the English language, and how thought is processed, if you will, using these two different modalities. And it's a fascinating book. It's not terribly academic. The first half is not terribly academic, and then he goes into more detail. But there's some fascinating stories. And the one concept I want to share with you is everything about Chinese culture, and of course, is embedded in the language, which is his point, it is relational. We think in terms of a large ecosystem, and I think this is very similar to what the Native American Indians do as well, because we understand that we have to be in harmony with each other as human beings and societies, but also with nature. And so we understand that everything is interrelated. You can't just do one thing without disturbing a number of other things. It is an unfortunate consequence of the discipline of scientific discovery that said, oh, let's reduce all the variables. So, because I was an experimental PhD myself, let's remove as many variables as we can. So we only have like one or two variables, and we can design an experiment around that, and then we can come up with some new knowledge, by the way, not necessarily a conclusion, but new knowledge that informs what we didn't know before about those variables. And that's a wonderful technique. It's extremely powerful. Scientific method has just made all kinds of things possible. So there's nothing wrong with that, but there's an abuse of the way that we think about that, and we use that methodology to reduce the complexity of human society. Human society is amazingly complex, and when you understand different ethnic origins and people from long-standing cultures, you don't know that, right? You have no idea what the cultural heritage is. I mean, we can give you some glimpses of it, and you read books and you go be a tourist, you're still only going to get glimpses of it until you actually do what Seth was saying, or suggesting, you learn the language, you go and you live and interact with people on more of a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I'm curious about maybe some of the changes in brain chemistry that go along with, and this has been studied, learning another language, thinking in a different language, et cetera. Mark, I know that's something you've studied, not around language specifically, but around the changes, the plasticity that happens in the brain in your research, in your case, specific to substance abuse. But, as a sort of a proxy for, our brains affect the way that we perceive things, and when we change them oftentimes for good, meaning permanently. I'm just curious if you could kind of enlighten us a little bit, at least in that domain, what are some of the effects of a change in brain chemistry?
Yeah, that's a pretty big question, but thank you for asking. So we had a session in here earlier today on the brain, the three-pound universe. That was a pretty good discussion among the panelists, and some sort of a little bit of controversy, which was interesting, about neuroplasticity and how we think about it. There's a lot of work in this neuroplasticity field, and there was one panelist in particular who was making the case that there's too much focus on it, and really it's sort of, why do we need to take it to this reductionist of looking at how the brain changes when we can know that the brain is changing because we can see the behavior is changing. And if I can use my answer to that to answer your question a little bit, I think it's stimulating our curiosity about the world around us is a really important thing. And that something like learning a new language is a form of learning that it opens up new possibilities. And that, to me, the whole idea about neuroplasticity that's so fascinating is that it opens up, and even just thinking about it, about how the brain specifically is changing, opens up new possibilities in how we think about ourselves and our relationship to the world. It does to me. I don't know if that's broadly speaking, people find that, but that's. So in terms of how the brain specifically changes neurochemically, It's incredibly complicated, depending on what type of learning you have, and whether that is maladaptive learning, like you'd get with exposure to chronic drugs of abuse or trauma, or whether it's something like learning a language, which is obviously pretty beneficial.
Yeah, I wonder how fast it starts when you get to a different culture, you start learning a language. Like, how fast is the actual chemistry in your brain start thinking, not just your mind opening up in a figurative sense, but in a literal sense?
Absolutely, immediately, because whenever you learn anything, your brain has changed. Your brains, and whether you like it or not today, your brains have changed in here. Hopefully it's for the better, but they're changing right now, so get used to the idea. But I actually, so I like to do experiments on myself, and usually they're benign experiments. But I thought, what is the hardest thing that I can think of that I could try to learn? And it's Chinese. And I thought, how is this possible? Okay, my daughter, who was 10 at the time, now 11, was playing around with this app on her iPad. And it was, you know, that you could use to learn languages. So I thought, okay, well, I'll try this for 5 minutes a day and see. And I've been doing this now for a year, just about every day. And, I mean, it's very, very hard to learn Chinese for me. But to me, it's opened my eyes to thinking about things in a different way. And you know, if there were indigenous languages that I could try to learn in this way, I mean, I would try that too.
There's an app.
Is there an app for that? There's an app for that. I have to get that for you.
I'm going to give a shameless self plug here. If you Google my name on YouTube, you will find a TEDx Hong Kong talk titled "Who Killed Curiosity?" And it's to your point exactly. Curiosity drives dopamine. Dopamine is released by the brain, and dopamine is one of these neurotransmitters that has a lot of different effects. One is pleasure, right? It stimulates the feeling of pleasure. It does a number of other things. But what is most interesting about dopamine and curiosity is it generates and persists in creating a positive feedback loop, meaning the more curious you are, the more dopamine is released, the more you want to learn more things. So that's a word of advice to everybody. It's good, right? You will feel better, you will learn more, and your brain will be very happy.
I love it. I think that's a good positive note to end on. Please join me in thanking our panelists. I thought that was a fascinating conversation. Thank you.